Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands, I'm Chris.
I'm Lyle, and another Wayne-less episode.
Indeed.
This is the last minute one.
Mm-hmm, yeah, well, we kept moving it back, and then because of Wayne, and then we couldn't do it anymore, because Wayne, and then Wing. Left. It's all his fault. Wayne.
He's a little tuckered out from buying our movie tickets for tomorrow.
That's true.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of movies, I saw that movie Divergent.
Oh, that's the
Hunger Games
latest. Okay, the Hunger Games ripoff. Yeah,
exactly. You know, it was surprisingly good.
Better than the Hunger Games?
I want to preface it with saying that I didn't read either book. And, of course, Hunger Games has many, many more acclimates than Divergent does. So maybe Hunger Games might be a better series, but I enjoyed the movie more. Even though the premise was kind of out there, it made more sense than the Hunger Games did to me. And it flowed a little bit better. I enjoyed it. Basically, the premise behind it is that they break society up into the different characteristics for people. So people who are kind of outgoing and adventurous and combative, they go into kind of the military wing. People who are inquisitive, they go into the science group. People who are altruistic and selfless, they go into the
medical group?
Yeah, medical, helping out the poor.
I don't know, yeah.
And also actually the leader group, the political group, because they're selfless, so they choose what's best for society and not for themselves.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And the idea is that the science group wants to take over because they think they're smarter. Well, I suppose they are smarter when it comes down to it, and just what entails from there. And Divergents are these people who have different character traits or all of the character traits within them, so they don't fit into any group and thus are somehow a danger to society. That it didn't really make that much sense, but it was fun to watch.
Didn't you say this made more sense than Hunger Games?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
But yeah, so I'm not giving that high praise of Hunger Games, but I don't know, it was fun to watch. But it was very obviously riding on the back of the Hunger Games popularity wave. That's the reason that it was made.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I started watching House of Cards, and I can give that an unconditional thumbs up. That was pretty good.
I imagine, yeah, you and everyone else is, I haven't heard a single bad review of that show, I think.
I rented the first DVD for House of Cards, and the first DVD for season one of Game of Thrones, so my wife could watch it.
Uh-huh.
And just, it was interesting to compare her reaction to both, and the big difference was that she could follow House of Cards more easily.
Uh-huh.
Whereas after the first episode of Game of Thrones, she's like, I don't know who anybody is.
I see.
So watching it again, I think they should have done something like what Ralph Bakshi did for Lord of the Rings or what Peter Jackson did for Lord of the Rings and have, you know, setting up about the rebellion or something.
Mm-hmm.
Where they got rid of the Targaryens, and so, I don't know, the Battle of the Ruby Ford, something like that, and just explaining, okay, oh, you know, Ned and Robert were friends, and the Targaryens, and you just, but watching that first episode again without reading the books, you'd be pretty lost.
Huh.
Yeah. And then forgetting that they insert Jaime in every, as much as they can, just to give him something to do.
Right.
Oh, and it's dark, you're getting up to go to the bathroom, hell yeah.
You've got a contract, get him in the scene. Well, that's cool.
Yeah. And tomorrow we're going to be watching Godzilla.
Yes!
Wayne's original idea, and it's odd that he came up with this idea, because I think he drinks the least of us.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to watch Transformers 4 and get drunk in the theater.
That sounds like a fun plan.
Yeah, and it was a fun plan, but then we started to backtrack a bit because we didn't want to give Michael Bay any money.
That's an even better idea.
So we were going to watch Edge of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But then we couldn't see that, and then we ended up going with our second choice, Godzilla.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This was a lot more dramatic when it was happening, but explaining it, it's actually a long, drawn-out affair.
Yeah.
Trying to get discount tickets and making the reservations and getting increasingly, not upset, but...
Yeah. Frustrated. No, the Japanese name is this. I know what it is!
Yeah. Oh, yeah, didn't you ask for All You Need Is Kill? Because that's what they call it here. I know that. That was the first thing I asked for. Just saying.
It's probably good to mention on the side that you can drink in Japanese theaters. They usually sell beer at the concession stand, just so everybody knows we're not like sneaking flasks into the theater.
But we're actually sneaking flasks and beers into the theater. But no one will say anything.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, that's our big plan, so we're really excited.
Yeah.
And I guess Wayne was so excited that he needed to sleep. Or he hyperventilated from his busy day.
I thought it was pretty apt, you know, us being in Japan and watching a Godzilla movie, so. You know, along with 130 other million people.
Yeah, but I think it's set in the States.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose if it was made in America and everybody speaks English and it's all white actors, yeah.
There's Ken Watanabe.
Ooh, well then, I stand corrected.
But in the States, I think.
Mm. So, yeah, anyway, I've heard good reviews of it, so I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Actually, if you don't mind, can I jump back onto Divergent and the Hunger Games for a sec?
Okay.
Because I actually wanted to say something, because about how I said that the Divergent made more sense than the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I think actually maybe in thinking about it, the plot of Hunger Games was probably a little bit more logical. The thing that got me was that there were several points during Hunger Games where things happened that didn't make any sense to me. For example, like the fire that was trying to herd her in one direction, but also seemed to be trying to kill her at the same time. Or how the opponents in the game were trying to kill each other, but they also sent out these deadly traps to try and kill them. That for me, while watching the Hunger Games, made me kind of go, what? A little bit. But there weren't moments like that in Divergent. So just kind of wanted to say that.
Okay, yeah. Because I think you guys talked about the Hunger Games in a previous episode, maybe one of the Lyleless episodes.
Yes, and then you guys told me I was wrong.
On it.
And, you know, it was a good point because to me, those things didn't make sense, and I still blamed the movie for that they didn't explain them properly. But after you guys explained how it was in the book, then it did make actual sense as to why those things happened.
Yeah, it's definitely portrayed as dangerous, but more as dangerous in an entertaining sense,
mm-hmm.
like, for the audience, but also to herd them. Where it was boredom was a bigger crime than killing a popular person.
Exactly, yes.
So,
and to me in the movie, I didn't understand that that's what they were trying to do, so that's why I was confused. Yeah. My small mind.
Well, from the traps of the Hunger Games to the traps that the English use against the French.
You couldn't go with that Katniss used a bow?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I forgot about that, yeah.
Oh, man. Where do you think I was going with that?
So from one archer to another, we're talking.
Oh, we're keeping that in.
Feel free to seg yourself, too. I thought you were focusing on the traps, so I thought, oh, you must be trying to use the traps to seg into our topic, which is our latest Warriors installment, and mm-hmm. It is the Longbowmen.
Yes, yes.
So even though we've talked about gender and being inclusive, unfortunately they were called Longbowmen, not Longbow
persons,
people. Yeah, or persons. But we're talking about the English or the Welsh Longbowmen.
Mm-hmm.
And for those unfamiliar with our Warriors episode, what we do is we take an actual warrior from history and we pull out elements that we think are particularly interesting about them and in some respects special mm-hmm. about them, and then talk about how those elements could be used to make your game or your character, and not necessarily a fighter character, more interesting or fun to play.
Yes, indeed.
And this one was one that we really wrestled with.
It was, yeah.
Because we wondered, was there more to the Longbowmen than the longbow?
Mm-hmm.
And so much so that we're going to actually flip our normal order, where we normally put the weapons that the warrior uses at the end, and here we're going to put the weapon that the warrior uses at the beginning, because it's pretty much defining. It's actually in their name.
Yeah, exactly.
So the longbow, if we are talking about those that became famous, at least outside of England, in the 15th century,
mm-hmm.
or the 14th and 15th centuries, particularly during the Hundred Year War.
Yes, indeed. Talking about, like, that's when it became the big thing in the world, where it kind of drove England's power. But it was an ancient weapon. I think the first recorded use of them was around the 7th century. But despite there being pretty good records of the battles back then, there isn't that much information on the longbow itself. In fact, most of the information we have about the longbow came from a shipwreck where they found a cache of actual longbows inside. So I want to give some stats on it, but I hope just everybody understand that it's these are hotly contested stats. In fact, you can find lots of forums where people are angrily debating each other over what the actual draw weight and range and everything is. So talking about a longbow, they're huge. They're over 6 feet long on average. I think the average for the ones found in the shipwreck was 6 feet 4 inches. They have a draw weight somewhere between 90 and 180 pounds, which, again, is probably actually one of the most debated parts of them. They have a range of somewhere around 300 meters with accuracy. They can penetrate iron plate mail. They had trouble getting through steel plate mail. And they could fire up to between 10 and 20 arrows a minute.
You know, the funny thing about the iron and the steel plate mail
mm-hmm.
is they found when they flipped it and went back to iron, it was actually better for guns.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because guns had better punching power, but the iron slows it down.
Did that be because of the impurities?
No, like steel is just stronger.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could punch through it, you can get right through it. Whereas if you had something heavier, like an iron, for whatever reason, it's like Kevlar, where I guess it uses up its energy.
Interesting.
Going through it, yeah. So anyway, but that's not the longbow, but that's interesting. Yeah, with the penetrating power, the Welsh and how the English were first introduced to it was on the wrong end of the arrow.
Yes, indeed.
And the Welsh would get up very, very close and ambush you,
mm-hmm.
and that would assist in their ability to penetrate armor.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the English, who use it further back, would have obviously less penetrating power. So that could be where some of the debate is about the penetrating power. So when you hear about the knights being killed, oftentimes it was their mounts were being shot from under them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising that not as many of them did survive, because the Tower of London was supposed to have several of them in the armory, as mm-hmm. well as arrows.
Yeah.
I think yew was the best wood. Like, there was a lot of different woods used in the construction, but yew was the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, from what I read, it said that yew was fairly unique in that the heartwood in the center of a tree or a branch was really strong and good in the compression, whereas the sapwood was very good with tension. So the combination of those two properties together made it ideal for a bow. All you had to do was just carve out the shape of a bow out of a tree, and you'd have an excellent weapon there.
Yeah. And the draw power, I mean, that really means nothing to a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing to consider is that the skeletons of longbowmen are recognizable because they were deformed.
Mm-hmm.
They would have, like, enlarged left arms and then bone spurs on their left wrists and shoulders and right fingers.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the difference in the arm size, that's a bit.
Yeah. Just think the incredible amount of strength you'd have to have. Just think about a 180-pound package, and I'm using the 180 one because it sounds cooler. Just picking that up, you know, and then doing that several times a minute for hours on end.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of that Michael Crichton. Oh, yeah, Timeline. Mm-hmm. It's a Michael Crichton novel about going back into time.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't about longbowmen, it was about knights. And people imagine, if you watch a movie like Excalibur, and people are struggling to move in their armor.
Mm-hmm.
But then they go back in the time and they see the knights moving quite quickly, and they're like, well, they train in this armor.
Mm-hmm.
So they're able to move quite quickly. If the armor's well made, it won't hinder them too much, because what was the point of doing that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we spoke about that in our knights episode, warriors episode, where, you know, knights, there are accounts of knights doing backflips and dancing while in full armor. So not in a battle, of course.
Just to show off. They did do some tests with the penetrating power, and it was able to penetrate mail armor.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. It's hard to say. There's because there have been a lot of different tests at a lot of different ranges, but one of the more difficult things is that nobody has an accurate account of the real range that they would be used at. I mean, we can test how far they can fire, but they would fire in volleys, so nobody knows how far they actually would fire. So that range is incredibly important when it comes to penetrating power. So it's just one of the things that we don't know. But we do know from accounts such as Agincourt that it didn't penetrate the steel breastplates of the French knights, but it would go through the thinner armor on their arms and legs, and of course would go through the joints. So even if your armor is enough to protect you, there's still some parts of your armor that won't protect you, such as the visor, the eye slits and such, and the joints again. And you think about going up against an army that's using these mass volleys of arrows. It would just be incredible. Sky blackened with them. The word for it is yeesh.
I think in addition to the penetrating power, the big advantage, maybe not the penetrating power's advantage over the crossbow, but the big surprise with just the longer range, greater accuracy, and a rate of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what caught the French off guard when the English brought them over.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they fire up to like 12 a minute, more than that. You can say maybe up to 20 a minute if they're really good, but they obviously, just like with an automatic weapon, you wouldn't expend all your ammunition straight away. But they would put them in front of them,
mm-hmm.
and had the double advantage of being easier to draw, or it helped them in their rate of fire, is pulling it from a quiver, but pulling it from the ground in front of them.
Yep.
And also then the arrows would be dirty. So it increased the rate of infection.
Mm-hmm. Which is just horrible when you think about it.
But I don't think that was actually their intent.
I agree, yeah.
Because it's not like you want that person to die of an infection 2 weeks from now.
Right, yeah.
we're going to win this battle in 2 weeks, you know. Hold on. It'd be like using nuclear bombs just to give the enemy radiation so they die of cancer in 20 years.
50 years, you guys are going to be ruined.
Yeah, their thyroids are gone. They're sterile now. Yeah.
Well, that was another part of it, too, is then talking about that, how they would, the English would stake out their position and they'd plant their arrows in the ground in front of them. But more than that, they would actually use these portable defenses that they would set up in front of them to protect them from the enemy's arrows or actually enemy charges as well.
Which is our second point, which mm-hmm. is a mobile defense. And we often think of like shields, you carry it on your arm. But yeah, the long bowmen would carry these stakes that they would put in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so important to the success of the longbowmen that when they weren't able to set it up at the Battle of Patay,
mm-hmm.
they were routed because the knights were just charged before they could set up.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as you have like the hail of doom or the blackened sky, and of course that's intimidating and lethal, but also the stakes that are just going to kill your mount as you ride up to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's something to consider. I mean, we often think of, you've got your archer character and you got to put the meat shield or the steel shield in front of the fighter. And in a sense, this is like a wooden shield
mm-hmm.
that they need to set up. And that's certainly a challenge if you have some sort of character that needs to set up their defense in order to be very effective. And we think wizards
mm-hmm.
are like that as well. But people have gone away from that. They want somebody who can be effective straight away, reduce the casting time. They want things that, you know, they can deal damage at a distance without any consequence.
Right.
So,
and also it's just cooler, you know, some guy can whip out the power anytime he needs to. But and like, for example, one of the types of defenses they had was called a mantlet, which was basically a little mini wall on wheels. And, you know, if you have a character just going around with this, you know, wall on a wheel, kind of thing, not quite as cool.
How did they find us again?
They did have some other cool ones, though. They had this one called a pavace, which is basically a tall, it was shaped more like a kite shield, but it was basically the size of a tower shield. But it had this long foot or foot and a half long spike sticking out of the bottom. So when you'd go on the ground, you just ram it into the ground and it would stand up in front of you. So some pretty cool stuff.
I mean, thinking Wayne's often compared, like, for example, D&D combat to two guys just running up against each other and wailing on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or running up to each other and wailing on each other. But if you think in this respect, if the guy has to put like this obstacle in the way, the kind of maneuvers that they can do then, it would be different from what they would normally do. I mean, you're putting in this, I mean, obviously their opponent is going to try to go around as opposed to through it, because it's just easier, but then it allows you to set up and in a sense call a shot, get ready for him to come around.
Mm-hmm.
So that adds some things, but in a sense the way we want to use archers now in games versus the way they actually fought,
mm-hmm.
it's almost the difference between sword and sorcery wizards and the wizards that we have now in our games.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there, you would have like whole chapters of them setting up rituals and to cast these spells.
Mm-hmm.
Or the whole thing was to cast a spell.
Right.
Whereas now, you're just firing them off as if they're guns, like your spells, mm-hmm. as if they're bullets.
Yeah.
So.
Kind of like the old clerical buffs, you know, bull strength, cat's grace. Let's get everything loaded up, blessed before the battle, and then go into it.
Yeah, but this brings back the idea of like preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't prepare ahead of time, then it doesn't matter how good you are with what you do. You're always going to be at a disadvantage because you're essentially a ranged fighter that's in close combat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they also prepared for that too. They would often carry backup weapons with them.
Yeah, and we initially thought it was just long knives, mm-hmm. but it turns out they carried a variety of weapons, either like a maul, if they were lucky, a sword, a billhook, or an axe.
Or a witty retort, something.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. But, I mean, of course, that's the thing. You're in a battle, so if the enemy does break through the lines and get to you, then you don't want to, you know, just have a very thin arrow stick to use as a weapon, so.
Legolas be damned, because he made good use to it. Even in the Battle of Agincourt, which is maybe the most famous battle that we've had the longbowmen in,
mm-hmm.
Not their most successful, but their most famous.
Yeah,
they have to close in with the men at arms because despite how successful they were, they still able to reach the English lines,
mm-hmm.
and they closed in with their melee weapons and used their better agility and just went for, as Chris mentioned earlier, just went for the joints and the exposed parts of the armor.
Right.
To take down the men-at-arms.
Yeah, and it's as I said before, even though the French knight armor would have protected them from a lot of the arrows, they would still be exhausted from trying to get up to them because they'd have to keep their heads down, again, to avoid getting the arrows inside in their face mask. And then it would be hot inside the armor. You couldn't move at full speed. And there was also some terrain effects there. But by the time they got to the English lines, they would be exhausted. So even a person with less armor and probably less training, then a knight would still be something of a threat. And they'd be in much greater numbers, too.
You know, with the defense, or what we've called the mobile defense, mm-hmm. perhaps a better way to put it would be obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Is putting obstacles in the way, and somehow using that with a character in that they're slowing the person down, and that's, if you want to do it mechanically, it's providing minuses
mm-hmm.
to the person. So by the time they get there, they're sufficiently fatigued that it evens out any advantage that they may have had at the beginning of the run.
Yeah.
And building a character around that, or having at least when you get into on the battlefield, is they're all about presenting obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if you took that even more broadly and did it in a social sense, that's their thing, is presenting obstacles
mm-hmm.
and attacking from a distance. And if somebody wants to get close, you see that it's a common enough trope where they try to get close to the antagonist, but they've got so many layers protecting them,
mm-hmm.
and they flipped it in something like perhaps Person of Interest, that TV series where you have somebody in the center but gets people around him, a team around him,
mm-hmm.
to do the job, but also to provide him with obstacles if anybody were to close in on him.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a really cool idea. I could imagine kind of the enemy coming towards the character, but getting caught in a trap or, I don't know, some kind of summoned creature getting in the way or something the whole time that that character is just plinking arrows at them, wearing them down for when they eventually do get there. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, when you're saying that, like with the summon, if we were going to do, you know, the longbowman, but reskin them as the wizard or something like that, where they actually set up. I mean, I suppose they could cast the summon monsters and just have them sit there.
Mm-hmm.
But also having things like trigger, like sort of magical traps triggering as it's whatever it is getting closer.
Mm-hmm. It'd be great for a PC. It would be terrible to use as an NPC because that would be so frustrating for a player. All right, I move forward. And he summons another creature. No!
I think with the it's not so much that would be frustrating, but the double threat
mm-hmm.
is they're getting the metaphoric stakes,
mm-hmm.
slowing them down, but they're also getting the rain of arrows as well,
mm-hmm.
and that would be deemed as unfair. Of course, when the players are doing it, that's great.
Yeah,
so that's good planning, DM.
Good way to get the characters to hate the villain, though.
Even like socially, you could be slowing down an investigation by attacking or doing stuff with the loved ones or the friends of the player.
Yeah.
But then also having direct attacks. And again, the metaphorical stakes with the metaphorical arrows.
Sorry, I was giggling, but I was imagining those arrows being, you know, just taunting from the pack. Some obstacles away. Come on, man. Can't you get any closer?
I remember 4E had Mocking Strike.
That's right, yeah. On rats.
So I guess 4E had something going for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was actually just thinking about that with 5E, is you could theoretically play a magic user as an archer, because the magic missile now, you can use it without exhausting it.
Oh, well, they always said the arcane archer anyway.
Mm, true, true.
You know, what was really helpful about the research here was how to deal with an arrow wound, or not a wound, but an arrow in you, and what's the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to soak a cloth and then tie it on the end and then push it through.
Mm.
Yeah, as opposed to pull it out.
Why is that?
Because it goes through easier, and then the cloth, I guess, will help clean the wound.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I asked that is one of the things that I looked up for the bows, and I've thought it was one of the coolest points, was the different kinds of arrowheads that they used. And it seemed the most common that the English used was called a bodkin. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correct, but it was a long, shallow, narrow point. It kind of looked like a four-sided nail, like almost a very long, thin pyramid. And they said that was probably created initially because it was just easy to manufacture. It also worked really well against armor for penetration. But the thing is, it wasn't flared on the end. It didn't have tangs. So it's odd to imagine that pulling it out would be difficult. Whereas kind of a broadhead arrow, where it's shaped like the classic large arrowhead triangle shape, it has the sharp edges. So when you try to pull it out, it would do more damage.
Right.
But, I mean, of course, I'll trust what the actual historian said, but it's just counterintuitive to what I thought.
Well, definitely with the broadhead arrow, you wouldn't want to pull it out.
No, no.
But with the bodkin, I guess if it was sticking in just a little bit, you would just want to pull it out because it's not going to do much damage. But
yeah, I suppose if it's already halfway through you, then. I just imagine if you push it through, you know, there's a chance that it might hit something inside and do damage to an organ or something.
Well, I guess if it's right above your heart, you wouldn't want to push it through the heart.
Yes.
Through your lungs or something. I guess they're assuming that it's already done.
Yeah, maybe.
It's damage, but I guess the idea is even with the bodkin, mm-hmm. it still has a point.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's designed to penetrate, whereas if you start to pull out, it can get snagged.
Hmm.
So.
Yeah, or break off or something like that.
All right. I hope we never have that dilemma where one of us gets hit by an arrow. We have to be a little bit of an arguing as the person bleeds out.
Did you see any of those arrows that had the crescent-shaped arrowhead on them? I think they're called roving arrows, but basically,
are they the ones that are cut lines and stuff?
Well, that I was reading about them, and that's what some people were saying, is that they thought they were to cut ropes on ships and such, but they did some tests with it, and they figured that it would never actually be able to cut a line on a boat, because most ropes would be far too thick to actually penetrate, and the rope would have to be extremely taut in order for it to not just kind of bounce off or bend with the arrow. But what they figured was that it was actually for pain. Those large curved heads would cause a lot of pain going into it, even though they wouldn't penetrate very deeply, which isn't very effective against people, but they said it was probably used against horses, because if you could cause enough pain to the horse, then it would bolt and retreat, whereas something like a sharpened arrow would go in, and it would cause a lot of damage, but it wouldn't actually cause enough pain for the animal to stop charging. Anyway, that's the theory, so I thought that was pretty cool.
I wonder if they tested that secretly.
You know, I was looking into it, and this isn't specifically English, but some other countries had some really interesting arrows. The Romans had these things called firebox arrows, which had these cylinders of pitch on the front that they lit on fire. And they used those against the elephants, because the elephants were scared of fire. And it was one of the only ways that they could drive away the elephants before they actually got to the lines.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The Chinese had arrows that they put gunpowder in, so it was rocket-assisted arrows. Awesome stuff. So yeah, have your archer use all of those. Learn from the superhero from the Green Arrow and all that.
Yeah, say like a boxing glove.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that one up too. Don't forget the nuclear tipped arrow. You know, just in case you need that.
Was there a nuclear tipped arrow?
There was a nuclear tipped arrow.
Like it was made from what depleted uranium and it was just had penetrating powder, or it was actually radioactive?
It was no. It was not radioactive. It was as in a nuclear explosion on an arrow. I'm not asking you to make any sense, but
was this in the 50s? What was this? And the English longbowmen did not have nuclear tipped arrows.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I think they primarily stuck to the bodkin and the broadheads.
Yeah, I think the bodkin was by far the main arrow.
And then they had maybe barbed arrows, so smaller than a broadhead, but definitely ones you would want to push through, not pull out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They also had thorns on the back, so it would hook on tissue as you pulled it out, doing more damage. They had double-pointed arrowheads, which did more damage when they were going in, so it was a very messy, nasty weapon. Not good at armored penetration, though. Basically the hollow point of the day. And they had signal arrows as well. They used arrows that were designed to burn brightly, and fire arrows, for that matter, for sieges. Again, it's not a English thing, but the Japanese had those whistling arrows that, as they shot up, the air would flow through them, and they'd make a high-pitched whistling sound for signaling a battle. So many fun arrows to use.
That is pretty cool, and certainly for people who want to keep track of like ammunition, and that's kind of exciting, then definitely play with that.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into like a more science fiction setting, you can do something along the lines of Judge Dredd, where he's got that gun and he just calls it out.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think of that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool gun. The movie Dredd does a pretty decent job with it.
I actually love the gun in the movie because of the voice they gave it. They had the voice actor do really well. The gun sounded like it was happy to be shooting it. Give me a grenade! Grenade!
I actually didn't remember that the gun talked.
I did, yeah, I did. It just echoed whatever he said. Rapid fire, kind of thing. Sorry. I geeked out a little bit there.
Are you talking about Dredd or Judge Dredd?
The movie Judge Dredd.
Which one, with Sylvester Stallone or?
Yes.
Oh, I was talking about with Carl Urban.
Oh, okay. No, sorry. So I said, rapid fire! Rapid fire.
No, yeah, you actually sounded like Carl. The gun talked like Carl Urban. Yeah, rapid fire.
The gun was actually suggesting it to him first.
It's foreshadowing a better movie. Yeah, the reviews were, I didn't really like Sylvester Stallone, but damn that gun. Just have more gun. Or maybe have Dredd just be like the gun. Now, the big downside of the longbow, other than the downsides we've already mentioned of kind of being a little bit vulnerable when they get up close to you, was that it was very difficult to use, and which is why when you think about, you know, battles, and we talked about this way back when we talked about in the war episode, when you have a superior technology, why don't you just grab it and use it? And one of the examples we used was the longbow, and that you couldn't just grab a longbow and then replace your crossbow with it. The crossbow was used because it was anybody could use it. So with the longbow, it required a lot of training, and which made the longbowmen true militia in the sense that they were just regular serfs or freemen, and they would be required to train every Sunday or every holiday, I think was the official law.
Yeah, and they set up archery games and events all over the country, and the king made proclamations. Every good man of England is to use his bow on every hunting occasion, proclamations like that.
Yeah, except not hunting in the king's wood.
No, yes, indeed. I guess the king's voice carried a little bit better than nowadays.
There was certainly a downside of this, is now you have an armed peasantry. But you want them to be armed because they're going to be your militia, but then it also puts a check on how you can treat them.
And especially in the case of the longbow, because they were so simple to construct, all you needed to do was carve out a yew tree, dry it for a couple of days, and congratulations, you've got one of the most advanced pieces of weaponry on the planet.
Have you ever carved a tree? You make it sound like, oh, you just carve a tree.
Well, you know,
you just carve a bow shape on the tree.
In comparison to maybe smelting your own armor, I think it's something that's possible for someone to do.
I think a club would be easier.
Yes. Okay, I'll give you that, yes.
A fist would be easier. Man, I had a bow when I was a kid.
Me too.
But it was one of those cheap, made of, I think it was made of bamboo. Or something slightly stronger than bamboo. See, I wouldn't even know which tree to cut the bow out of. I'd be like on an oak tree cutting. Oak tree doesn't bend. What? Crack.
Yeah. My family had a really nice bow. I remember playing with it all the time. I never actually strung it up and fired it because it was the pull was too heavy for me as a kid. But we used to do archery a lot in Boy Scouts, and I was really good at it back in the day.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Now, we used to fire arrows in the woods, which was pretty dangerous because even though they were plastic tip, they still would have penetrated.
Mm-hmm. Wait, when you say fire darts in the woods, you mean at each other?
No, at trees, but somebody would be standing near the tree, and none of us were particularly good.
Yeah.
But no one got hit. But, I mean, you think back to the kind of childhood we had.
Back in the day,
it'd be like child abuse.
When we were using our longbows, just like in 1603.
Back in the day, every Sunday. Yeah, I know I had a couple swords and axe, like nice. Wall weapons, but you wouldn't have been able to get much swings out of that axe
mm-hmm.
before the head went flying off.
Into a friend. It's okay, didn't feel he'd already been shot by the longbow.
I think that's that's obviously our next element. It's just the idea of like training or standardized training or being a true militia,
mm-hmm.
where you have obligations regardless of what you are. Your particular status means that you have to do that, and it was also tied to how much money you made.
Yes. If you had land worth $2 or more, then you needed to do a longbow.
Was it $2 or £2?
Probably £2. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. American.
So $3. I'm sorry.
And if you had that, then, and obviously you weren't rich enough to have a horse and that, then you would fall into the longbowman category.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And again, they encouraged everyone to do it. Not if you had the land, you were required to, but everyone was encouraged.
We've often talked about, especially when we talk about the military campaign or the campaigns where everybody is the same
mm-hmm.
or shares something that's similar. And it could be this militia training where they all do that, but they all come from different backgrounds. They could have the doctor, and I think I've just run out of jobs that would be exciting to play.
Oh, they'd be the farmer and the, exactly. the rancher.
You know, and they would all contribute in their own way to the story. The lawyer would talk a lot.
So you're a poor English serf. All right, cool. How about yourself? Oh, a poor English serf. Excellent.
So, but y'all did. I mean, there's certainly been a few. Maybe one. What's the one called Southern Comfort, where they're all during the National Guard?
Sorry, I'm not familiar.
Well, if it is called Southern Comfort, then it's not a bad movie. It's similar to Deliverance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's less rapey.
That's good.
Yeah, but it's just something to bring people together. Actually, they didn't make much of their different backgrounds or where they came from, but that's certainly something that you could do.
Mm-hmm. And the way that you could do that would be that playing up the idea of militia, in that everyone there, it's not a volunteer force. They're required to as a service to their king and country. So you could play that. There might be some people who are very patriotic and they want to be there against the evil French or whomever. And then people who just are there because they have to. They miss their family and children back at home. Of course, they die first.
But it's a great way to mobilize the group together where something bad has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're all called up. Mm-hmm. And you can even have mystery because you don't have to tell them, really.
Yeah, true.
So what is it? You see that in like zompocalypse movies and stories where the National Guard's called up and they're like, oh, what's back there? I don't know, ma'am. You know,
what's
just
going
something.
On, sir?
Yeah. You even do that in the medieval times and they're being used as almost like the city watch for some reason because there's some apocalypse or something happens and then they've got to defend the town or things like that.
Well, that'd be awesome. I could imagine that where you get on the campaign, you don't know what you're facing up against, but you can only see it in the very far off distance. Maybe these creatures, they're humanoid, but they're taller than a man, all wearing this black armor, but you can barely make it out from where you are. All you're doing is following instructions to loose. Maybe you win the first battle, but it's still a big mystery what it's about. Well, that could be a lot of fun.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. At least initially, I think if session after session was... Yeah,
of course.
In the distance. You don't know what they are.
What was that movie? Battlefield LA or something like that?
Oh, Battle Los Angeles.
Battle Los Angeles, yeah.
That's a good movie. I like that movie. But I think they were regular troops.
Oh, they were, yes. But yeah. It was kind of that building on the mystery. Like, first, you don't know what's going on, and you're slowly getting peeks at what these things are. For example, finding a body after the battle or something along the line.
Yeah. Or you could use, like, the Hundred Years' War, where... They were, you know, you call them up and it's like, now we're going overseas and we're going to fight a battle.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is, it's, you've got to just survive.
Mm-hmm.
A Feast of Crows, I mentioned before that I'd recently reread that. And they have a good part in that book where the guy's explaining what, you know, about the broken men, those people that go to battle, mm-hmm. and they're called up and they don't know why and nobody's trained them or anything. Mm-hmm. Well, at least the longbowmen has the advantage that they are actually trained.
Yeah.
And, you know, just trying to survive and doing that and deserting and doing horrible things and having to attest for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in D&D 5e, the soldier background has one of the things where they would forget which one of their things it is, but where they've done terrible things or they have bad memories of what life was like.
Mm-hmm.
So it haunts them to this day.
Yeah, especially if you used it in the longbow in the siege tactic. You just rolled up to a town, loosed a bunch of arrows, maybe even flaming arrows. You never even got to see the people, but you know they were there.
You were like the drone pilots of the medieval time.
Exactly. That's actually what I was thinking of when I mentioned it. But, you know, actually, that kind of flipping it, that's one of the things that I think would be really interesting in a game, is not the protagonists as a longbowman, but the antagonists. And this is something that they used in that movie Hero, I think it was called. It was a Chinese movie similar to the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and where the bad guys was an army of longbowmen. And I think they make excellent enemies because they attack from far away, so they're kind of a faceless threat. It's this wall of death that comes at you. There's not really anything you can do to fight back against it unless maybe you're on horseback so you can get to them quickly enough. It's almost like a force of nature. But unlike a force of nature, it's also directed by an intelligence, and it can be a malign one. So I think they make excellent villains, longbowmen, a longbow army.
An entire army.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, especially thousands, if arrows are... thousands. You know, you could have just thousands of people with fists, and they would probably make a pretty decent army against like a party of four people. It's like, oh, I'm going to cast Fireball. All right, you kill 100.
Maybe yeah. Not as
many. And they swarm you. There's certainly that. I mean, I think it's easier to visualize if they're guns,
mm-hmm.
Using that from a distance, because what we talked about before with the obstacles as a setup is that they need to set themselves up and put themselves in formation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it was the Welsh which would ambush you,
yeah.
from the trees. So that would be pretty cool and pretty frustrating.
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to go about it. You know, when I first heard this topic of longbowmen, I just imagined the English longbowmen where you're in an army and you fire a bow. But there's lots of different ways to use it. There's, as you mentioned, with the Welsh where you'd actually have to sneak up on your enemy and try to get them at short range, maybe because they have thick armor or maybe just that's the tactic you prefer. That's more like a classical D&D ranger. But it's also worth mentioning that Robin Hood, he used a longbow in the classical stories. So you can still have kind of the lone adventurer who uses archery as his main weapon. You can also take the idea of a sniper as well, and that can work either as your protagonist because you have to be very stealthy about it, or as the antagonist. These arrows are coming at you and you don't know from where.
I thought about playing a sniper in your game.
Mm-hmm.
When I realized the two-weapon fighting was a really bad idea for my rogue,
because okay.
I just didn't have the stuff for it. But I figured that you would want, if you're going to do a sniper, mm-hmm. you would want to go crossbow. And the reason is you got to be, mm-hmm. you got to hold the position for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you could do that with an archer.
You wouldn't be able to hold the bow taut for a long time, but you could still draw it slowly up once you have your bead on the target.
You would certainly be a marksman, but mm-hmm. maybe the sniper, the way we imagine it now, where a lot of it is setting yourself up
mm-hmm.
and waiting for that one shot.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking like the sniper battles that occurred in Stalingrad.
Yes.
Between the Russians and the Germans. And most of the battle was like tricking your opponent and mm-hmm. finding good camouflage and finding that position that you can stay in
mm-hmm.
for all day
yeah.
as you wait.
Yeah, it's hard. I used to do the sniper role when I played paintball back in the day. I just didn't have the patience for it. If a mosquito bit me or something, I'd always swat at it and give away my position, that kind of thing.
Oh, what were the roles in paintball? It'd be like sniper,
Well, there'd be sniper.
Guy who runs and shoots.
But no, the sniper usually has a team member whose job is to attract fire or attention if as need be, or to help spot. Yeah, and of course you would have people who were, paintball is just our high school friends, so people who were faster and better at running, people who had more balls than I did, they would charge the enemy. But we also had people who did command, people who were good at rapid fire, so they would take up fortified positions and offer suppressive fire. We were pretty into it.
What about multiple longbowmen, where they are performing different roles within the group?
Mm-hmm.
Like some of them are designed, like are there ambushers? Some of them are there to lay down a withering fire. Some designed to get up close. Or I suppose you would have to change up the bows a bit, but you would have a group of bow people.
I think that could work really well because the tactics that you use with a longbow are pretty well suited to using the same tactics across the group. For example, if you're using the mass volley fire in an army, obviously having lots of people with you has a huge benefit. But also if you take the more stealthy approach where you're sneaking up on different people, you know, you have the fighter who charges out there that, of course, is an effective fighter, but that gives away your position. The fighter might be in the way of your arrows, and it's not conducive towards a good surprise attack. But if you had several people with a longbow, at once, you could fire from one direction as the enemy's scouting out that direction. You can fire from another direction to sow confusion. Or you can attack all at once and you don't have to worry about hitting your own allies in it to just get them all down with fire at once.
Also, giving them different arrows that they can use.
Mm-hmm. Yep. One guy has the pain arrow, one guy has the nuclear arrow.
Yeah, why would you need the other guys if the one guy's got a nuclear arrow? And done.
Fun campaign, guys. Good game.
Well, I'm kind of veered a little bit off the militia track, but Final Element was the status and honor idea, and that, yeah, the bow was associated with peasants.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that it was a weapon commonly used during something like the Peasants' Revolt. Even though they had to have own land worth more than 2 pounds in which to have the bow, and people below them would be like, have knives or halberds. It was still considered a lower class of weapon, certainly lower than the knights.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is another one of those things that I found was contentious about the bow, is it really seemed to depend on who you were, or rather what perspective you had on life as to how you saw the longbow. Because obviously the knights and the professional fighters, melee fighters, of course, they looked down on the longbow and they thought it was a very dishonorable weapon because it was kind of their Achilles heel. In that they could be attacked from a long way away and they might die before they even had a chance to use their skills. So they didn't like it very much at all. But by a lot of the peasantry, they saw the longbow as a very honorable and impressive weapon for reasons, not the least of which being that it took a lot of practice and a lot of power and a lot of skill to be able to use it proficiently. It wasn't like a crossbow where you just pointed it at the enemy and shot. You had to spend years being able to shoot the longbow, and that was something that gave it something a bit of a status. Hey, after all, you can see Robin Hood, how popular of a character he was, and not a small part of it was because of his archery skills.
Yeah, and tournaments would have the archery competition, in addition to the joust and the melee. I would imagine that their purse was a bit lower.
Probably, yeah.
But it was certainly there, and I guess it gives like the common people something to... I'm sure they cheered for the joust and the melee as well, but it gives them someone to identify with, and also the common people a chance to win something.
Mm-hmm, so. Absolutely.
But getting into the animosity, and I guess it's the longbow and the status ideas that you automatically have an arch enemy or a favorite enemy, and that is the knight. The knight fights completely differently. The knight has a different status, or the men-at-arms, they fight differently and have a different status. And, I mean, there's the story where they would cut the two fingers off the hand of the longbowmen.
Right, yeah.
As punishment. Because around about the Hundred Years' War, you would often ransom people. You wouldn't necessarily just kill them. So they might end up using them some sort of prisoner exchange. But before they would give them back, they'd cut off their fingers. So the people say that the English equivalent of the flipping the bird, the two fingers facing forward,
mm-hmm.
with the palm towards you,
yeah.
That was like the longbowman's way of flipping the bird to the knights, just to show that they still had the fingers and therefore could still fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's surprising. Just looking this up, sorry, this is kind of going on a tangent, but it's amazing how many phrases we use in English that came from the longbowmen. So I was being high strung is if you're, because it comes from your bowstring being too tight, keeping something secret, you're keeping it under your hat because that's where people kept their bowstrings to keep them dry underneath their hat. Playing fast and loose comes from the volley fire, where saying fast was a signal to stop shooting and loose was to shoot.
Was keeping it under hat from the longbowmen? Because didn't people
from
often put something under their hat?
Okay. of course, I don't know the truth, but the article I read said that they kept their bowstrings under their hat to keep them dry, and that's where that expression came from.
Well, I mean, that actually relates. That is so off topic from the idea of the like taking some sort of gesture or offensive gesture, and it comes from a very specific, or like it comes from a specific warrior or something that happened to that warrior, mm-hmm. but also expressions as well, and that's a way to like give the world a little bit of richness,
mm-hmm.
where people say something because it's related to the particular warrior. So if you have, let's say, to borrow from Martin, Dothraki, there should mm-hmm. be like expressions that people use mm-hmm. related to the Dothraki, or gestures or things like that, and mm-hmm. that will give the world a bit more history and a bit more life.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gives the characters themselves like that common lexicon, like that common dialect or slang.
Yeah, kind of having your character hold out their hand and getting ready, loose, for that when they fire off the arrows. It can really get you into the mood.
Get loose. So that wraps up our episode on longbowmen. And the elements that we looked at were the weapon itself, which included not only the longbow, but the backup weapon. Looked at mobile defense or obstacles that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
We also looked at training or the militia training,
mm-hmm.
as well as status and honor.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway from me this whole topic is how amazingly diverse the longbowmen can be between all the different kinds of specialist equipment that they use, the different kinds of tactics they can use against their enemies, and the different classes and views that they can be held in socially. It's a really wide range of characters that you could make with this. I think a lot of fun. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idlered Hands. Check us out online at www.idlerdhands.com, idlerdhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idlerdhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idlerdhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. All right, bye.
Drive-Thru RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Oh!
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.